Well, I spent my boyhood in Brainerd, Minnesota, and grew up on the Mississippi River. After leaving there, I went to school in St. Cloud, again on the Mississippi River. Later on, I spent 4 years at Iowa State College in Ames, Iowa, but I did all of my research on the Mississippi River at Keokuk, Iowa. Later, I taught at the Itasca Biological Station for the University of Minnesota, and I spent quite a bit of time at Cape Girardeau, Missouri, too. So I've been up and down the river a lot during my lifetime.
What is it about the river that sparked your interest initially?
Well, a river is an extremely fascinating thing to study because it's constantly changing, where a lake changes too. But to state the case for a river, a lake is mortal. A lake is born and goes through youth and middle age and old age and finally dies, where a river is immortal. A river flows forever. No matter what we do to it, the river will be there. And I think that in the future, our rivers are going to hold more promise than many of our lakes, because a river can even cleanse itself after man has defiled it. And there are other reasons too, but those are some of the main ones.
Why, in your mind, is the Mississippi River so important to the United States?
Well, the Mississippi, at first, was exploited as a water highway to the sea, where we could bring trade goods into the interior of the North American continent to exploit it quickly by water much more easily than we could overland by wagon or some other route. So for transportation, it was very important, and it still is for transportation. But the Mississippi River is also extremely important for recreation, and it truly is a multiple-use resource. It's even used for water power in a couple of instances, but mainly it's transportation and recreation. And those two things are coming into conflict more and more.
I'd like to talk a little bit about that conflict a little bit later. But first of all, I'd like to ask your opinion about the health of the Mississippi River. How do you feel the river is getting along now as we approach our 200th birthday in this country, and I suppose our 200 years of use by the white man?
It's always dangerous to generalize, but I'll attempt to do so. I would say, in general, from its source at Lake Itasca to the Twin Cities area, the Mississippi River is in very good shape, with minor exceptions. At the Twin Cities, the quality of the water in the Mississippi River takes a drastic drop. And even though great strides have been made in the metropolitan area to step up the quality of wastewater treatment, still, the step-ups in quality of wastewater treatment haven't completely offset the increases in population within the area. So the net gain isn't as great as you might think. The Twin Cities pours thousands and thousands, millions of gallons of sewage into the Mississippi River daily. And still in the Twin Cities, you have combined sewers that dump in raw sewage on occasion when there's rapid runoff on the streets, because there are combined sewers that can't handle the combined load of sewage water and rainwater. So during high rainfall, there is still raw sewage going into the Mississippi River. But the Mississippi begins to cleanse itself immediately, as soon as the river passes the Twin Cities. And by the time we get to Red Wing, the river is getting in pretty good shape. And then farther down, Lake Pepin acts as a settling area. I hate to say that all the time, but it does. It acts as a settling area for a lot of the pollutants from the Twin Cities, which have been recycled maybe a couple times on their way to Lake Pepin. But then the river is diluted by clean water from the St. Croix and from the Chippewa, so that by the time you get to the foot of the Lake Pepin, the Mississippi River is in pretty good shape. And I'd say it would be safe for water contact sports like swimming and water skiing and so on. And it remains that way all the way down through Minnesota and the northern part of Iowa. And then it begins to degrade again. The river becomes overwhelmed by the combined pollutants of the Quad Cities area and so on. And my own feeling is that by the time the Illinois River runs into it, the river is pretty bad. When it leaves St. Louis, it's not much of a river anymore. It's a big ditch. It's not dammed up below St. Louis, but it's a big ditch that runs to the Gulf of Mexico. It has levees on either side, and it's not much.
What's the caliber, then, of the river life, or what's the quality of river life below, let's say, St. Louis?
I really don't know. The river below St. Louis is a very, very poorly studied area. It's a, well, to give you an example, the ultimate example, I guess, would be what it's like. What would the river bottom be like at New Orleans? I don't think anyone knows. Because how do you study a river that's 200 feet deep, and it is at New Orleans, that's flowing at 2.5 miles an hour? I don't know of any equipment that I could drop down and really sample the bottom of that river effectively. So it's, I don't know much about the river below St. Louis. Above St. Louis, I feel comfortable. Below, I don't.
There's a great deal of controversy about what's happening to the Mississippi River through the manipulation of man. We know, for example, that the Corps of Engineers and barge interests, for example, have generally been on one side, hoping to dredge the Mississippi deeper, create a better, wider, and deeper channel, if you will, for barge traffic. On the other side have been the people who maintain that habitat area must be maintained. Could you give us a Could you sketch in some of the background of that conflict for us?
Some of the listeners may not be familiar with this lock and dam system on the river, so let me maybe explain that a little bit. The Mississippi River above St. Louis originally was too shallow for very deep draft boats. And over the year, the river has been modified to make the channel deeper and deeper and by various means. But in the 1930s, to make the river 9 feet deep, the Corps of Engineers was authorized by Congress to build a series of navigation dams, which made the river into a series of lakes, with the river flowing through the lakes. And each of the dams ranges in height from only 5 feet, maybe up to 40 feet in height. And it makes the river into a series of aquatic steps, with a minimum depth of 9 feet deep in the channel. Building the dam has been not enough to maintain that 9 foot depth, however. The Corps has also had to dredge the channel to keep it 9 feet. So it's a combination of impounding it and dredging it that has made the 9 foot channel. The impounding has done some remarkable things for the river, some very good things. It made more water surface per linear mile. There's just more water now because it's widened. The river at in southern Minnesota is much wider, for example, behind the dams than it is at St. Louis or New Orleans, where it isn't dammed up. So we have more water per linear mile. As a consequence, we have more pounds of fish per linear mile than we had than when the white man came. And the river, as it flows along the border of southeastern Minnesota, is a resource that not many Minnesotans really appreciate, and they fail to understand, I think, that there's tremendous fishing there for walleyes and sauger, sandpike, northern pike, and crappies and sunfish and so on. A tremendous resource, very fertile, high number of pounds of fish per acre. And there have been other goods associated with that 9 foot channel project, like deepening the river so people can water ski, so people can do pleasure boating. They've, the Corps of Engineers with their dams has even made duck hunting much, much better than it used to be along the river. But there have been some real bads, too. And the biggest bad, I guess, associated with it is the sand that's constantly dredged out of the river. The Corps has run out of places to put sand. I guess that's the simplest way to say it. And the beautiful marshes that were created by building the dams in the 30s are now being filled with sand. And the impoundments themselves act as catch basins for soil and sand that wash in from poorly managed farmland and from highway construction and other things. So that, in summary, the Corps created a recreational paradise when they made the lock and dam system, but the recreational paradise is dying because of encroachment of sand. And that's our basic problem. What do you do with all that sand?
Now, I think your work out of Winona State College indicates that there's reason for hope. But before we get to that, I'd like to delve a little bit more into some of the management techniques you mentioned, management techniques of people who live along the river. What do you have in mind?
Do you mean for saving the river? Well, the hardcore environmentalists have pat answers for the problem. And their very simplistic approach would be, when asked, what can we do to save the river, is blow up the dams or something. Well, I think that's silly. You can't blow up the dams. The dams are there, and they serve a function, and they're vital for transportation and so on. Likewise, another approach is that you cannot, if the Corps dredges any sand, make them take it out of the river valley, up to the top of the bluff or something, but get it out of the river. Now, that's fine, but I personally don't feel that energy-wise we can afford the energy expenditure to take the sand from the river up 500 feet of bluff to get rid of the bluff, or even to get rid of the sand, or even to take it completely out of the floodplain. That's a partial answer. Sand should be taken out any time that it's feasible. When someone needs the sand, for gosh sake, give it to them. But there are some places in the river where there will have to be, in my opinion, central disposal sites. But I don't think that has to be so bad. I envision a central disposal site as being an area that's riprapped with rock. The rock strategically placed so that it creates smallmouth bass habitat and channel catfish spawning habitat. The riprap rock enclosure would be filled with sand, which would be protected then from flood. The sand pile, very high, maybe we'll make this thing a minor mountain, 75 feet high or so, would be capped with muck from silted-in backwaters. The muck is high in phosphorus and high in nitrogen, and we'll make the sand into a prairie, and we'll maybe manage it by fire with a by burning the prairie as we manage prairies all over the world and create wildlife habitat in doing so, so that we would make an island in the river that would be suitable for camping, that would have vegetation on it above flood level for nesting ducks. So we'll create duck habitat and duck food in the form of terrestrial vegetation, a multiple-use resource created out of a commodity that no one wants. And I think we will see these things in the future.
And what you describe, as I understand it, isn't a romantic vision on your part. You've done some of this work, as I understand, with taking muck from the backwaters and spreading it on sand.
Well, it's kind of a romantic idea in one respect, that we're not capable. I don't have the capability to make one of those yet, but I will suggest that and hope that we'll be able to do the research necessary to do it, make a demonstration project. But we have, on a small scale, revegetated areas already. And our method was very low cost because it was by volunteer. I have a way of getting students to volunteer. And the students helped me, I helped them, vegetate a small part of a sand island where we went into the backwaters where there was a heavy accumulation of muck, this nutrient-rich muck. And we carried it out with buckets, which is very, very hard work. We carried it up the sand and dumped it out, mixed it in with the soil, and seeded it and fertilized it a little bit to make up for a potassium deficiency, and mulched it. And in a year, we had a good stabilization of the sand. And we prevent the sand from blowing into the backwaters then by stabilizing it. And we also hold it better against the onrushing floods in the spring by stabilizing it. And our results there are so promising that I think we could do it on a large scale. We planted this stuff in August, which is a terrible time to plant anything on sand that's 120 or more degrees Fahrenheit. Burned your feet. You had to wear shoes when we planted. So we overcame some very severe obstacles.
What about residents along the river? Farmers, people who live in towns. We know, for example, that Twin Cities residents contribute significantly to the pollution of the Mississippi River, but what about the management practices of farmers and others who live along the river? Are they major contributions to problems of river pollution?
I hate to say it, but farmers are a major source. I hate to say that, really, because over the years, I've worked with soil conservation and with farmers a lot, and I have a lot of respect for the farmers and for the problems they encounter. And they do have problems with the weather and everything else. But nevertheless, I think it's only fair to state that in recent years, I've been appalled at the regression that I've been seeing in soil conservation, where typically the grandfather plowed up and down the hill. and learned. You shouldn't do that. You should contour and strip crop and do all of these things and make terraces and so on, cover crops, rotate crops or whatever. And the father carried that on. And now I see the grandson in his race to make a buck, and he needs money too, I recognize, but in the race to make money because of the financial bind the farmer's in, he's plowing land that his father would never plow. He's grazing hillsides that he should not graze. A typical one would be the man who had a lot of cattle, and suddenly the price of feed grain went way up. He couldn't afford to feed the cattle he had, so what does he do with the cattle? Let them run on the side of the hill or through the woods or whatever. And this poor land management is seen in soil erosion. We had a flood on the Whitewater River in Winona County just recently. Jesus, it devastated the little town of Elba. And we consider that an act of God. Well, it was to the effect that we had a heavy rain. But I can't believe the devastation would have been as bad had the land been under proper soil management. It's terrible. It's not only the farmer. It's not only the farmer. It's every hiker that kicks sand off the side of the hill with his feet. It's every road builder that isn't careful when he's doing construction. It's a suburban housing tract developer. Man, by his mere presence in the valley, hastens the relentless cycle of erosion.
Returning to the issue of the channel in the Mississippi River that barge traffic requires to move up and down the river, providing major source of commerce for the United States. Now there's talk, of course, of the 12 and 15 foot deep channel in the river, and I'd like to get your opinion as to how you feel about expanding the depth of the Mississippi River for barge traffic and how you think that will affect the river.
This is, as you know, a very complex issue. Right now the river is 9 feet deep, and the barges can carry 9 foot deep cargo can transport 9 foot deep cargo barges up the river. If the river were made 12 feet deep, they'd be able to haul 33% more cargo with the same crew and the same towboat. So they could haul goods much less expensively if they could increase the depth of the river. But increasing the depth could cause some severe environmental problems. One would be, well, there are two ways to make the river deeper. One is to dredge it deeper. If you dredge it 3 feet deeper, what do you do with the sand? The sand is already a problem. This would aggravate the problem. Another way to do it would be to raise the river level 3 feet, or a combination of the two. Dredge a half, 1.5 feet, raise a foot and a half. Impounding a foot, 3 feet, has some scary things associated with it, and I doubt if that would even be done in the form of possibly aggravating flooding. That's a long story, but I think it could. And the other thing that people worry about with a 12-foot channel is that it would cause just bigger or deeper toes, that the toes may be harder to manage, there may be more accidents, or that if an accident does occur, that the consequences of the accident would be greater. An oil spill. Let's say a barge full of oil encounters a wing dam and tears a hole in the barge, we'd have 33% more oil. Those are some of the worries. The most controversial thing is the development of Lock and Dam 26 at Alton, Illinois. And the environmentalists there are very concerned because they feel if they make that lock and dam there with the sill of the lock about 20 feet deep, this would make the capability of traffic on the river not 9 feet, not 12 feet, but 15 or more feet. And that if Lock and Dam 26 were completed, it's the bottleneck, by the way, on the river, that would increase traffic tremendously on the upper river, just removing that one bottleneck because it slows traffic so much, that the increased traffic on the river would cause problems. To kind of summarize how I feel, I feel that the river can be managed as a multiple-use resource, that surely we should not stop transportation on the river. The river would be a lonely place without towboats, I feel. But we can't have transportation at the expense of the environment. And if we work at it and use some imagination, I think we can have both. And I see some promising signs. Just with the Corps of Engineers, In the past, if I talked like this in public, in the past, like let's say 8 years ago or so, I was chastised a couple times by the Corps of Engineers for talking without facts. I don't feel I was talking without facts, but they felt I was talking without facts. But recently, I find the Corps, at least in the St. Paul district where we are, much more cooperative, and really, they recognize they have a problem, and the Corps itself has hired excellent research personnel, excellent biologists, to help them solve the problem, and they work with us. And the most exciting thing, I think, is the formation of a group called GREAT, which is the Great River Environmental Action Team. And the GREAT team is made up of representatives of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, the Soil Conservation Service, the Corps of Engineers, and about everyone you can name, every agency that could be concerned with the river, even the Coast Guard. And this Great River Environmental Action Team is divided up into work groups, like transportation work group, new equipment groups, fish and wildlife groups, and I should have mentioned the Fish and Wildlife Service, which is involved. And they are using their combined knowledge to find techniques to rectify the damage that has been done, to see if we can slow down the rate of degradation, or to stop it, or even to reverse it, and to make the river a better place than it is. And there, right now, there's research funded and by GREAT to find out what can be done. And at Winona State College and at St. Mary's College in Winona, we have a very active program on the river. We have 20 people working full-time this summer on the Weaver Bottoms to find out, to diagnose the sickness of Old Man River. And when we have diagnosed the sickness, then we'll prescribe what should be done. And hopefully we'll see things done. There'll be new channels made into recreation areas in the next few years. Some portions will be blocked if it conducts flood water and silt when it shouldn't. And we'll see some exciting things happening in the next few years.
Galvin Premling, Professor of Biology at Winona State College, thank you. I'm Dan Olson.
Thanks, Dan.